Well, it's fun to come and be a part of your meeting tonight. You guys get together every week? Is it every week?
Great.
Well, Paul asked me to come and talk about relationships, and I guess you've been doing some kind of a series on relationships, and so I don't know where I'm at in the series, but we'll do the best we can. I love relationships. I'm sure you love relationships, too. If you've been around the Christian life, that's what the whole thing's all about, right? It's all about a relationship with God and a relationship with others. And, of course, that is the summary of the law, vertical focus on God and then a horizontal focus on others. First four commandments focused on God, the next six focused on each other. And so, you know, relationships is what it is. And it's fun for me to come and to be a part of a meeting like this, especially since it's here in the Silicon Valley. I lived for 7 years in Phoenix, Arizona, and we're just three and a half years new to this community. So it's a much better place to be right now than in Phoenix, Arizona. Anybody been at Phoenix during the summer? Say, did you grow up there? You know the area? Yeah, well, there you go, right? Isn't it great to be here right now? And, you know, if you've been reading the weather reports, you know that they're already in the hundreds over there, and they're going to stay in the hundreds for probably 100 days or more in a row. And I think it's like up to 108 in Phoenix right now or the next couple of days. So I actually ended up at a church called Bethany Bible Church over there. It was a church that way back started with the desire to have as its first pastor J. Vernon McGee. I don't know if you've ever heard that name. You here at this church know Ray Steadman's name. Well, J. Vernon McGee was like about that same time, and he was a pastor in Los Angeles area at Church of the Open Door, very popular pastor. He's still on the radio, even though he's dead. But, you know, some people, like, they're listening to him thinking, this guy is fabulous. How do I get a hold of him? Go to heaven, okay? You'll find him. That's where he's at. But anyway, so he still has his radio ministry. And this church that I went to called him up when he was a pastor in Los Angeles. And they said, we'd really like you to come and to be our first pastor at this new church we're starting. We're going to call it Bethany Bible Church. And he said, there are three reasons I would not come to Phoenix, Arizona to be your pastor. June, July, and August. And if you've ever been there, you know it's not just June, July, and August, but it's like months around June, July, and August. And so, you know, we love living in this area, except for the housing. This is ridiculous. We have never seen anything like this in any community that we live. But my wife and I, we've been married for 37 years, so we're really interested in relationships. We have three kids. They're in their 20s, and one's in his 30s, young 30s. And so we've had the privilege of raising them and trying to do our best to help them. Two of them got married already. One of them, our daughter, who's the youngest, has just met a special guy. And they're probably going to get engaged. They finished the book, and, you know, so, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what's going to happen. But he already asked me if he could marry her, so I kind of take it that they're, like, going in that direction, if he had the courage to ask me all of that. But with that book that Paul held up, it's a fun book in the sense that they were trying, my oldest son was trying to figure out whether or not they should get married. And most churches don't have any help in that area. You have help usually after you make the engagement decision, but not before. But usually, if you need help, you need it before you make the decision, because 90% of couples who decide to get married are going to go ahead and get married after they make the decision. So they don't undecide to do that. And they were trying to make that decision. So they helped me write the book. They respond to the information in it in real time. And it's kind of like their personal journal all the way through it as they're trying to make the decision. They did end up afterwards getting engaged, and now they're married. But anyway, so I have a real interest in relationships. And so it'll be fun to talk about this tonight. And if it goes well tonight and you'd like me to come back next week, then I hear I'm going to be able to do that as well. But, you know, the area that we're in here is like any other area, relationally challenged, wouldn't you say, when it comes to relationships. I'm meeting on a regular basis with a trainer at 24-Hour Fitness. I know I don't look like I train over at 24-Hour Fitness, but I do. But anyway, so I meet with this trainer for lunch, and we get together and we just talk about his relationships, because he is the epitome of somebody who doesn't have a clue of what to do in relationships. And right now he's in another meltdown deal with a woman that he's living with. And we talk about it, you know, and how she's just so possessive and she wants to marry him and he doesn't want to marry her. And, you know, but they're living together and they're having sex. And I said, do you think that there's like any indication at all to her that you might be interested? I mean, first of all, you invited her into your home. And secondly, you're sleeping with her all the time. Do you think that possibly you're projecting to her any idea that you have an interest in marriage somewhere down the road? He said, well, I'm not feeling that way at all. I said, well, how many times have you already done this, you know, with girls, lived with them and, you know, gone through this whole thing and they melt down and they freak out. Then you guys don't have a relationship afterwards. He said, well, this is the third time. And I said, you know, this time maybe you can learn something from the situation and begin to do things different than you are right now. But the fact of the matter is that's a lot of what's happening in the community that we live in, and maybe it's a lot of what's happening in your life or has in your relationships. Hopefully not, but you know what's going on there. I was reading an article that was published in the Washington Student Life newspaper, Washington University Student Life newspaper. They call it Stud Life. And this guy who was writing this column was talking about how the student body needs to have some better help with regard to relationships. He was lamenting the fact that his girlfriend broke up with him, and so he's now processing this in print, you know, in the Stud Life newspaper. And he's going on and on about how the school needs to have some guidance in the all-important relational issues that the students have. And he said, you know, this school is focused on like two things. One is helping people find the right career, and the second thing is helping people find a great relationship. And he said, we as a school do a good job with the career part of it, but we do virtually nothing to help students get the relationship thing right. And so what ends up happening, and you guys know this, what ends up happening is we just kind of end up making it up and doing what we think is the right thing to do, which today usually means that couples start a relationship with a hookup that then oftentimes leads to shacking up, that maybe leads to walking up an aisle and eventually getting married, but usually that will lead to splitting up. So it goes from a hookup to shack up to walk up maybe and then splitting up. And so essentially what we have today is couples thinking that's the best way to get into relationships. What do you get when you get that? Well, here's just a statistic for you. Of eight couples that lived together before marriage, four will marry. Four of those eight couples will marry. Three of the four who marry are going to divorce. So one out of eight couples who lived together before marriage will actually stay married. But of course, what happens is they bring into the relationship the residual of what they started the relationship on. You say, what's that? It's a performance-based relationship. It's a tryout. See, the whole reason the couples live together before marriage is, besides the convenience factor and, you know, the financial factor and the intimacy factor and all of that, but often there's this factor of, well, we just got to like try each other out. Now, I don't know how you feel about tryouts. You know, I hated tryouts. That's why I quit playing basketball, because I failed at junior high tryouts at basketball, you know. I haven't even watched the series right now. I just don't even want anything to do with it. I still have an injury in my heart related to basketball. I probably need therapy in this area or something. But, you know, I don't know how you felt about tryouts, but that's what a living together relationship is. It's a performance-based relationship. If maybe, perhaps, you perform at a certain level and things are like right, then maybe we'll pull the trigger. And the hope is, and I really understand this, the hope is that in living together before marriage, we'll beat the odds. We won't, you know, end up splitting up like my parents split up, or the people down the street, or some friends that I know. They ended up getting a divorce, and it was over. And I just hope that if we do this, then it won't happen that way. But the reality is that if couples that don't live together before marriage, 50% of them divorce. Of couples that live together before marriage, 75% of them will divorce. So actually, it increases the odds that you'll get a divorce if you live together before marriage. But why do couples do that? Well, because it seems right. It seems like the right thing to do. I mean, it just, we're trying to put this relational thing together, and so that seems like the right thing to do. Remember Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12? It says this. You guys know this verse. There is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end, it leads to death. It just seems right, but in the end, it leads to death. I don't know if you would remember this, but a few years ago now, there was a Metrolink train crash in the Los Angeles area, and 26 people died. And when they did the study, the investigation, to try to determine what exactly happened there, what they ultimately found out was that the engineer was text messaging. In fact, he sent 22 different text messages in the several minutes leading up to the plane, but the train crash, where which came as a result of running one of the red lights, a signal. But 26 people died because the guy was text messaging, because at the time it seemed like the right thing to do. You remember the Costa Concordia Italian cruise ship that a couple of years ago decided that they would take a little excursion by the shoreline? Do you remember that? Reading about that or hearing about that, but he wanted to show the ship off. This is what he said. He wanted to show the ship off to the people that were on the land. And so they went off of the cruise channel, and they went into this area there. And ultimately, they crashed the ship. And I think, if I remember correctly, something like 32 people died. They lost the ship. All because, at that point in time, it seemed like the right thing to do. And so all I want to say by saying this is, this verse is so applicable to what's happening in relationships today, because we're making it up. We're like, you know, I could do this. Yeah, I think I know how to put a relationship together, and so we do what seems like the right thing to do. A few years ago, I was with a guy who came in for a session just to ask me for my advice on relationships. He said, you know, Dave, I was married for 7 years, and then we broke up, and we tried to save the marriage, and we lost the marriage, and we got a divorce, and it's been about 3 years or so since then. And now I have an interest in a couple girls, and they have an interest in me, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, like, which one should I have more of an interest in or whatever. And he said, you know, I really don't want to mess this thing up like I messed up the last one. So he asked me, what would you recommend? You know, and you got like one session, right, to talk about relationships and try to do something for a guy that's already been married and now he's divorced and he doesn't want to make the same mistake. And so what do you say to him that could actually, you know, help him do something different that would accomplish what it is that he's looking for? Unfailing love in a relationship. Isn't that the truth? Wouldn't you, whether if you have a relationship or you ever get into a relationship, isn't that what you'd like to experience if it's going to be a long-term relationship? Unfailing love. You'd like it to last. What's it going to take? Well, what I did was I drew for him a triangle. This is all I did. I had a little piece of paper there, And I said, you know, from my perspective, this is what good relationships are all about. And it's understanding this concept and keeping this concept in mind. And essentially what it means is building a strong spiritual foundation, building a growing emotional connection, and having a, I call it a neo-virgin commitment to the physical. A new commitment to virginity in the physical. And what I took him through was just a couple concepts I thought I'd share with you right now, and we could talk about it if you'd like, to any level you want to talk about it. But this whole spiritual matter first, this strong spiritual connection, for me, when I think about a couple building a strong spiritual connection, they're doing something that doesn't seem right, but they're doing something that is right. And I often take couples to Hosea chapter 10, verse 12. You familiar with Hosea, the book of Hosea? I love this book. Of course, it's a description of God's love relationship for Israel and how Israel had blown it. And it tells this incredible story of Hosea and Gomer. And we're not going to get into the Hosea-Gomer story, which is a whole story in and of itself because of her unfaithfulness to Hosea. But later on in the book, Hosea chapter 10 and verse 12, it simply says this. It says, sow for yourselves righteousness and reap the fruit of unfailing love. And really, you could just stop right there because that's what a couple wants to experience. They want to experience unfailing love. And what this passage is saying up to that point in time, it's the result of sowing righteousness. If you want to reap the fruit of unfailing love, sow righteousness. And then it goes on and it says, "But and break up your unplowed ground." So you could get this picture of hard ground that in no way is going to be receptive to the seed unless it's broken up, unless it's soft and, you know, it's capable of allowing the seed to embed itself and ultimately produce its fruit. And so it says, "And so break up your unplowed ground, for it's time to seek the Lord." I mean, of course, at that point, Israel needed to seek the Lord because they were facing potential judgment. And so he says, so it's time to seek the Lord until he comes and showers righteousness on you. And so you have kind of these bookends of righteousness, and the verse is really centered on the concept of sowing righteousness. Of course, the question is, well, what's righteousness? I mean, righteousness is essentially doing the right thing. But here's my favorite definition of righteousness. Righteousness is knowing what's right and doing what's right no matter what. Righteousness is knowing what's right and doing what's right no matter what. Now, I love that definition because, see, even among Christians today, there's confusion about what's right. So, for instance, just take the two areas that many Christians are living the same way that unbelievers are living, with regard to sex and with regard to living together. There's virtually no distinction anymore. It's really tragic. And I hope this isn't the case here. But it's really tragic that so many Christians today have bought into the culture's standard of sex. And basically, there isn't a standard. There is no righteousness when it comes to sex. It's just, hey, you know, have at it. So you have the whole area of abstaining in a relationship before marriage, according to the scripture. But then you also have this living together matter, which the thing that got me to write my first book, which was before that book called Before You Live Together, was the growing trend among Christians to live together before marriage. So I've been in ministry now, this is hard to believe, since 1971. May not be hard for you to believe. You're looking at me like, yeah, you really look old. You know? Not hard for us to believe that. But I've been in ministry since 1971, and so I've been around long enough, you know, since dirt, to see things change. And things have really changed. And back in the 80s, I was beginning to see more and more couples coming in for premarital counseling that were already living together, and these are couples that were in the church. And at the time that I wrote the book, the statistic was 2 to 3 out of 5 couples that would claim to be born again would live together before marriage. And now that statistic is 3 to 4 out of 5 couples that claim to be born again. When I came to here, Los Altos, 3.5 years ago, the first three premarital counseling sessions, first three couples that I worked with in premarital counseling, all three of them were living together. All three of them. Okay? So that's just like the trend. It's just the way things seem to be now because it seems like the right thing to do. In fact, the neighbor across the street, my wife was having a conversation with her recently about our daughter Katie and how since she moved over to Merced, California. Anybody know where Merced is? Yeah, it's surprising you even know where it's at, you know. But anyway, so she's over in the San Joaquin Valley in Merced, this small town there. And she went there about a year ago. She changed her career. She was a flight attendant, and she gave that up and said, you know, I really think I'm wasting my giftedness, so I'm going to go back and get my teaching credential and teach in school. And she did that, which is amazing, you know, in this time in California, of course, when teachers are being laid off. And God gave her a job over there. Well, what happened this last year? She just finished her first year there today. But what happened this last year was she met a really special guy over there, and they're probably going to, you know, get engaged and get married. But our neighbor across the street was talking to my wife about this recently, and Bernice said, you know, they're probably going to get engaged to be married. And the neighbor said, so when are they going to start living together, or are they already living together? And my wife said, well, they're probably not going to do that. And my neighbor was like in shock. You know, what, are you kidding? They're not going to live together? I mean, I've had couples come in and I've asked them, so are you going to live together? No. Well, how do your parents feel about that? They feel we're making a mistake. We need to live together before marriage. So there is a whole different thing going on here with regard to this factor of sowing righteousness. And I really think the sowing part of this needs to be understood. Because this is the law of the harvest. And you guys are familiar with the law of the harvest, right? You sow something, but when do you reap what it is that you sow? Do you reap in the same season? No. You reap in a whole different season. So a lot of couples or singles or whoever it is that are disobeying God's divine plan, they're ignoring what's righteous. A lot of couples, they don't see right now the consequences of the choices that they're making. Why? Well, because this is the law of the harvest. You sow in this season, but you reap in another season. You may not see in this season the results of the choices that you're making right now. I mean, it may look just fine. But you're going to sow ultimately something that you're going to reap. And you may not reap it now, but you will reap it later. You're familiar with that verse in Galatians chapter 6. Where it says, don't be deceived, God's not mocked. Whatever a man sows, this will he also reap. I mean, you may not reap it right now, but you're going to reap it. Eventually, you'll reap what it is that you're sowing. That's why oftentimes when I'm trying to help couples make a new decision about living together before marriage, I'll say, you know, you really need to think about this in light of your children and your grandchildren. And do you want the best for them or not? Because the choices you're making right now are ultimately going to set a standard for them. It's a different season. It's the law of the harvest. It's not the law of Pinocchio. What's the law of Pinocchio? The law of Pinocchio is you do something stupid right now, it shows up on your face for everybody to see. Lie today, and there it is. But you can do the wrong thing right now related to a relationship in God's eyes and not see it. All because we didn't break up that unplowed ground. So all I'm saying by suggesting this is one of the huge things that you and couples need to do is to consider whether or not they are building a strong spiritual connection with each other and with God. And ultimately that comes from sowing righteousness, which is knowing what's right and doing what's right, no matter what. And by the way, the no matter what part of this today, here's oftentimes what happens. but it's just cheaper to live together in one place than it is to live in two. And so now the financial piece has become the determining factor for no longer doing righteousness. Knowing what's right and doing what's right no matter what. When I meet with couples and we're talking about the spiritual piece and where's the spiritual piece fitting into your relationships, oftentimes when I don't know them, I'll just ask them a couple of questions. I say, tell me a little bit about your spiritual beliefs. That's my favorite question. Paul mentioned that, you know, one of the things you guys want to do is have an impact in the community on others. My favorite question to ask people is that question. Do you have any spiritual beliefs? I could meet Laura right here and hardly know anything about her and say, you know, hey, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself. Do you have a family? Do you live in the area? Do you work at Google? Where do you, you know, what do you do? You know, I have no idea what you do, Laura. But anyway, so is that how you say your name? Okay, good. All right, I'm sorry if I got it already wrong. But anyway, so I could do that. And then in the course of that conversation, say, do you have any spiritual beliefs? And because of that simple question, we could get into a spiritual conversation. Just depends on how she answers the question. I love to ask that question. Well, I had a couple a few years ago come in. They came in for counseling. It was an interesting situation. Actually, he walked into my office a few days before they came in for counseling. I didn't know him. He just came in to check my printer. Okay, it was, I don't know why. Somebody sent him in to check my printer. So he comes in to check the printer, and I'm like, okay, we've got a golf tournament this Saturday. Our church was sponsoring a tournament, and I wanted somebody else to play on our team. It was an outreach kind of event. And he looked like a golfer, whatever a golfer looks like, right? And so I said, hey, you want to, you know, play golf on our, do you golf? He said, yeah, I'd love to play golf. I said, that would be great. And so he said, let me check with my girlfriend, and called me back a couple days later and agreed to play. We played golf together on that Saturday. He was really good. We actually won the tournament. So it was like, thank you, Lord, for sending that guy into my office. What a gift from you, you know, but it was amazing. So we had this great time, and he showed up at church the next day. I didn't know him from Adam. I mean, at the end of the tournament, after a guy told his faith story, I turned to him and I said, do you have any faith at all? Any interest in God? He said, I kind of have a little interest in God, but that's about it. I said, well, man, we're here to help you any way we can. If you ever like to come to the service, or we get together and talk or whatever, come on over. Well, he and his girlfriend came the next day. They came up after the service and they said, hey, we like how you talk, so we're wondering if maybe you would marry us. And I said, well, that's an interesting way to, you know, get into this conversation. And so we set up an appointment. So anyway, we get to this appointment that week. He comes in. She's supposed to be there with him, but she doesn't come in. Evidently, she got stuck at work. So I'm thinking, okay, we'll just talk about spiritual things and some other stuff. We talk for about an hour and a half. This never happens to me. Does this happen to you? This never happens to me. At the end of the time together, he says, I want to receive Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. I mean, it never happens like in one conversation a person says, I'm ready to receive Christ. And so I help him come into this relationship with Christ. It was a cool thing. But now, as a pastor, you're thinking, well, wait a minute. Okay. I really don't do Christian and unbeliever weddings. You know, you don't marry a Christian to a non-Christian. I have some standards the Bible teaches about that. So I'm thinking, this is going to be interesting when we get together with her. So she comes in, we set up an appointment a couple days later because it was going to be a hurry-up ceremony. And I met with the both of them now. And I know nothing about her, so I asked her the same question I just asked you or suggested to you. That question of, do you have any spiritual beliefs? Question I had asked him. So I said this to her. I said, do you have any spiritual beliefs? She said, well, yeah, I really do. I said, no kidding. And by the way, at this point, I had already found out that they were living together. They had bought a home together. So they're like doing the whole thing just like everybody else is doing. And I said, so that's really neat. Tell me a little bit about that. I grew up in a Christian home, and God's a really important part of my life. And I love Jesus and gone to church all the time. And so that's just really important to me. And I said, well, that's wonderful. And a follow-up question I often like to ask at this point is, so what place do you want God to have in your relationship as a couple? You have some spiritual beliefs. What place do you want God to have in your relationship? Well, I didn't ask that question. I just jumped to the next one. And the next one was, can you help me? And I know this is a very personal question to ask. But could you help me understand, how does living together fit your spiritual beliefs? She stopped. She started crying. I had to get up from the table there and go over and get the Kleenex box. He's looking at me like, and what kind of counseling is this? Because his girlfriend is now full of tears. And I got the Kleenex box and I brought it back and sat it down there. And she started to talk and she said, well, it doesn't fit my spiritual beliefs at all. And I don't know that anybody had asked her that question before. I'm not really sure. You know, we didn't go there. But I knew exactly what was going on at that point in time. Was she was experiencing the release of guilt that had come because she had suppressed the work of the Holy Spirit in her. She was sowing unrighteousness instead of righteousness because of the decisions that she was making. So when I talked to this guy in my office about, you know, I drew the triangle, we talked about all of that. And this would be the conversation that I would have with you too, that if you really want to put yourself in a good place in a relationship or in your dating relationships or in a future relationship, start by building a strong spiritual foundation. This strong spiritual foundation is that foundation that first connects with God and says, I'm going to do righteousness no matter what. I want to know what's right, and I want to do what's right no matter what. It's that connection first. And getting that connection right, then it's getting this spiritual connection right with that person that you're building this relationship with. You want to build it on a spiritual foundation. And by the way, just go back to the triangle in your mind for a minute. Here's what happens in our culture today. We invert this pyramid. We invert this triangle. We turn it upside down, and most relationships start on the physical. They start on the physical. And they virtually never get to the spiritual until the couple finally decides, well, we think we want to get married, and so we need the blessing of God. And so they come to maybe a pastor at that point in time. In fact, I just had that happen this last year with a couple. They came in, they're already living together, they had already bought a house together, and they already had a baby, which has become much more a part of the culture today too, right? Already having a child outside of the marriage relationship. And so they come in and they said, we are here because we need a pastor to marry us. I asked them the spiritual belief question, and both of them are unbelievers, so they don't have any relationship with God. And I said, well, this is really kind of different. Why do you want me to do your wedding? And I began to find out that they had already, both of them, been divorced before, so this is their second marriage. And she said, well, the reason why I want you or somebody like you to do this wedding is because when I got divorced, I said to God, if I ever get married again, I'm going to get married in a church before an altar. And I said, okay, well, we got the church part of this, but I'm not sure about the altar part. You know, as far as I know, we don't like have any altars around here. She said, well, what do you got? So we went on an exploratory tour of our church looking for something that looked like an altar, and we ultimately found something like this, you know. And I said, well, we got this. How would that work? She said, yeah, that'll work fine. So I ended up doing their ceremony, a ceremony that I would do of two unbelievers. It was really amazing because at the first part of the ceremony, they walked the baby up the aisle too. I've never seen that before. That was a new one for me. And the kid sat in the front row. But they stood on the other side of the altar and I stood on this side. We did this ceremony. But they said, the reason that we're doing this is because we want the blessing of God on our lives. It's an inverted pyramid. And what I'm suggesting to you is don't let it go that way. Now, let me just touch this, and we'll stop, and we can pick this up next week, which would be fine. Then there's this second factor, which is the growing emotional connection, this emotional connection. And I think this is just fascinating to just talk about, because oftentimes this is a piece that couples aren't consciously thinking about, or individuals aren't consciously thinking about what we really need to. You're probably familiar with Romans chapter 12. There's a whole section in there in verses 9 to 21 that just talks about healthy love and healthy relational loving relationships and that thing. Well, in the midst of that, you find verse 10. And in verse 10 of Romans 12, it says, "Love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor." And this is really a neat phrase to get behind and just, you know, do a little bit of work in the original languages, because that first word for love there is the word that we get Philadelphia from, you know, the city of brotherly love. And so it's this philos word, philio word. And then the brotherly affection word is actually a combination of philos and storge. And so it's the love of a friendship, but it's also the love of a family, of the love that you have for a family member, so a healthy family relationship. And so what this is saying is that we're to love one another as friends. There's to be that emotional connection that we are to have with each other, but also we are to share in this friendship, family kind of love as well, a deep, abiding commitment, open, vulnerable kind of relationship with each other. What's interesting, because the Gallup organization did a study some years ago on marital satisfaction, and they found that the number one quality that was in marriages where couples were satisfied was the friendship factor. And in fact, they found that in 70% of marriages that were satisfied, that friendship accounted for the overall marital satisfaction. It came up to number one in that relationship, which means the emotional connection. We're talking about in friendship, we're talking about an emotional connection that's made between two people. But just being together doesn't guarantee that. Doing what seems right doesn't guarantee that. Let me just give you a quick example on that. I did after the first book came out, Before You Live Together, I did a bunch of radio interviews, and there was a radio interview out of Colorado Springs. It was on the phone, but the producer came on, he got me on the phone, and he said, "They just announced the topic that you're going to be talking about living together before marriage." And he asked the radio host asked people to call in, and this was a 90-minute show. So we were going to be on the air for 90 minutes to talk about this subject if there was enough interest in it. So the producer gets me on the phone and he says, "Okay, they've announced the topic," and as soon as he announced the topic, all of our phone lines lit up. I said, "How many phone lines you got?" He said, "We got 10. And all of them lit up. So there must be a lot of interest in this. And I heard that the first guy that you're going to speak to is somebody who's been living with his significant other for 10 years, and they don't see any reason to ever get married." So he said, "So have a good time. It's going to be fun for you, I'm sure." And we got into this whole thing. We started to go. And about the fourth call in, this woman named Michelle called in, and she said, "Let me tell you my story." She said, "We lived together for 2 years. Before we got married, then we got married, then both of us found Jesus Christ as our personal Savior. And now it's been about 2 years since that, and now we're in intimacy therapy counseling." And I thought, well, this is interesting. I said, "Tell me, what do you mean by intimacy therapy counseling?" She said, "We don't have emotional intimacy in our relationship. You don't have it." In other words, here's a couple that's lived together 2 years, then they got married, then they found Christ, and they don't have emotional intimacy in their relationship. Why? Because doing what seems right doesn't necessarily build emotional intimacy into the relationship. There was a study that was done some years ago by Desmond Morris. Desmond, that just kind of reminds you of a show that used to be on TV, doesn't it? That name. Nobody else has the name Desmond. But anyway, he did this study, and what he found was simply this. How well a couple bonds, and what he meant by bonding, how well a couple bonds, what he meant was how deeply emotionally they're connected. He said during the courtship period, the dating period, is the key, listen to this, to successful marriages. How well a couple connects emotionally, he's found, is the key to successful marriages. And what he found is that couples are more likely to bond emotionally if they haven't rushed the dating experience and they gave each other plenty of time to develop a heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul relationship. And he found that couples that bond the best are couples that go through a sequence in building intimacy in their relationship sequentially and slowly. And so he talked about 12 stages in a relationship. Eye to body, eye to eye. The eye to body is you just see the person. You don't know their name. They catch your eye. We use that terminology sometimes. They're cute to look at, whatever it is. Eye to eye. Now they see each other. They make eye contact. And maybe there was just something there. Voice to voice. They actually now have a conversation. It's no longer they just see them across the room, but they actually start to talk to them. And then they move to a hand-to-hand. Of course, that's a progression of intimacy at this point, where now they're holding hands. Then there's a hand to the shoulder, which is a little bit even more intimate. A hand to the waist, which is more intimate yet. Face-to-face, it's not just seeing each other face-to-face, but now we're talking about a couple kissing. And then a hand-to-head, which is even more intimate yet. And so, or even you could say at this point, a hand to hair, which is more intimate as well. And he said that when couples develop the relationship with this kind of sequence slowly, they begin to bond more emotionally deeply. And then he went off to say this, but they need to hold back on these areas that first one shouldn't be there. Eye to body. See here, it's hand to body. Okay, yeah, skip that first one. That's out of sequence. But hand to body, mouth to breast, touching below the waist, and sexual intercourse. And of course, what you're talking about at this point is you're talking about a relationship that's moved toward some kind of physical intimacy. And what he's saying is if couples move into these stages while they're dating, it stunts the emotional growth in their relationship. In fact, he just simply summarized it this way. Bonding is damaged when couples skip or scramble the stages. Now, what's he saying? He's just saying that couples need to give time in their relationship to the emotional factor or the emotional connection in the relationship. You ever read Song of Solomon? Yeah, maybe you have. If you're a couple and you're reading this together, I always tell couples, if you're going to read this together, you better read it like in a well-lit room or something, you know, with a lot of people in the room, because it is a crazy book, you know, when you're reading through it, especially like in the Living Bible version or something like that. But it's fascinating to watch what you have here, and, you know, there's a lot of sort of interpretive stuff going on here, and some people think it's a book of allegories of Christ's love for the church and all of that, and I don't agree with that. I just think it's meant to be taken literally. I think it's the literal description of the love relationship of Solomon with the Shulamite woman, his first love. I mean, the guy really messed up big time later, right? Which shows anybody can mess up down the road. But at this point, I believe he got the whole thing right. And so you're watching them develop this relationship, and they got it right. They built a strong spiritual connection, and they built a strong emotional connection, and they were madly attracted to each other. I mean, if you read the language, you know that they were, you know, really attracted to each other. But there's this phrase that's used more than once in the book, and it's simply this: do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Do not arouse or awaken love until its soul desires. What are they talking about? They're talking about the desire to share together in physical intimacy. But they're saying, but we're not going to go there. We're going to wait. And so you have this couple that waits, and then ultimately they consummate the relationship on their wedding night. In other words, they develop the relationship slowly and properly. They built the emotional intimacy. So let me just say something about this to us guys. This is going to be tough for us guys. This really is. Because for most of us guys, we are emotionally challenged. We really are. I mean, this isn't like the best thing that we do, which is build an emotional connection. And we have a hard time building an emotional connection with each other. I'm talking about an emotional connection. I'm talking about a heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul connection. You know, you've heard the, we're soul brothers. Well, you know, a lot of times we aren't anywhere close to being soul-to-soul brothers with each other. I mean, we get together and we talk about oil filters and other things like that. I mean, you know, that is just not going to build like the soul-to-soul, heart-to-heart emotional connection. Girls get this for the most part. I mean, just genetically, I think, you get this. You know, I was at Starbucks doing some writing here a couple years ago, and a couple girls came in, and they sat down at the table next to me. And I could usually write with the headsets on and pretty much ignore what's going on around me, you know. But they sat down, and they just started talking and stuff. And then a few more people came and joined them at the same table. And then a few more came, and they pulled up another table. And a few more came, and they pulled up another table. And so now you've got three tables, and I can't take it any longer. So now I'm kind of tuning in, you know, eavesdropping on this conversation that's next to me. I know it's rude, and it's the wrong thing to do, but it's what I did at this point. Because they're, like, taking over. And, you know, Starbucks aren't that big anyway, right? So they're, like, taking over the whole thing. And I notice when I look up that they're wearing these black outfits. And these black outfits say on them, Jazzercise. Jazzercise, you know. Something. Okay, so this is like a Jazzercise festival or something. I don't know what this is. A convention in Starbucks of Jazzercise, you know, or whatever. So they're talking and stuff, and they're getting their drinks, and they're having a great time. And this goes on for about 45 minutes. And I'm thinking, okay, well, this must be like the meeting of Jazzercise tonight or something like that. That's what's going on here. They're having a meeting. So I'm looking for the agenda. I can't find an agenda. As far as I could tell, for 45 minutes, they didn't have an agenda. They just talked, like, for 45 minutes to each other about whatever. You know, it was just like whatever kind of conversation. And I remember as they finally, you know, they started to disperse slowly, you know, they just kind of laughed, and there wasn't like anything that they accomplished. Nothing. It was just, you just got together and talked the whole 45 minutes. And I remember thinking to myself, no guy would ever do this. Guys would not come in here and just, hey, let's just have a Jazzercise huddle right here, you know, and let's just talk. Let's just talk. I mean, we would get together and say, what's on the agenda? You know, how long is this going to take? I got to get somewhere, you know, and all the rest of it and all that stuff. See, that's just like not natural for us. I coached my kids all the way through, you know, in different sports. And my daughter, you know, she just was a whole different temperament this way. We put her in track, and we'd have to go get her to come to her event because she would say, Do I have to go run my event? Yes, Katie, you got it. It's your time. It's your time right now. Well, I want to just talk to my friends. You know, I just want to stay right here and talk to my friends. When I coach soccer with the girls, and it's not always like this, I'm not stereotyping, but I'm just saying that on my particular team, when I coached the girls, they were asking me, can I sit on the bench so I could talk to my friends, you know? Now, that's just like a different thing. That's all I'm saying, okay? But the point is this, is that guys, we're not naturally bent that way. We're not naturally bent to sit down and talk to anybody about anything for any length of period of time. I mean, usually what they're telling girls is, if you ever want to get a guy's ear, catch him while he's driving his car, and you could sit in the next seat next to him and he doesn't have to look at you, you know? And then you could have a significant conversation with this guy or something like that. But I want to say this, you know what? It's possible. And you know why it's possible for us guys to have a soul-to-soul relationship? Because of the work that God can do in us. And because you have great examples like 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1, where it says the soul of David was knit to the soul of Jonathan. And if those two guys could have soul-to-soul relationship, well, we could too. And what I'm suggesting here is that one of the greatest things that you could do in a relationship, you could go miles forward in a relationship if you will develop the spiritual and you will develop the emotional. You will work on becoming best friends without allowing the physical to stunt that relationship. And oftentimes what happens is when the physical starts stunting the relationship, the couple keeps coming back to the physical to try to fix what's missing. It doesn't fix it. By the way, there was a study that came out by two sociologists in Christianity Today, and they were talking about marriages that make it. And they're talking about how the majority of marriages that fail today in America are missing emotional intimacy. And so this is what they said in their report. The extent to which he, speaking about the husband, is affectionate. And if you want a definition of what an emotional connection is, here you have it. The extent to which he is affectionate, to which he is empathetic, to which he is basically tuned into his wife, this is the most important factor in predicting the wife's happiness. Some of you grew up in a home where you're married, your parents had a terrible marriage. And my guess is that in some ways it was probably connected to this factor right here. There was no emotional intimacy in the relationship. And that emotional intimacy often is connected to there's no affection, there's no empathy. Do you know what it means to be empathetic? It means to be in the feelings of another. It means to get into their feelings. If you really empathize with another person, you're not doing what so often we're doing in the Silicon Valley, which is you tell me your problem and I'll fix it. Okay? I'll fix it. That's not empathy. Empathy is to get into the feeling so that you're able to understand where they're coming from and feel what it is that they feel with them, even without fixing it. And this is one of the big problems in relationships today between guys and girls.